start out with a very short, it's about 5 minute video that you're looking at it, just for looking at it. Today, it'll give you an idea of the repression that that folks are facing in the state of Oaxaca. And I hope the light's already gone once.
But it's not, is it about yesterday?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes, it's about
you guys are up to date.
Do you know the story of why people are protesting in Oaxaca?
We just came from Oaxaca. Three of us came this morning on the bus.
Okay.
From and you Oaxaca
know about,
last
does
night.
Does anybody know about the Guelaguetza?
Yep, we were at it.
You were at it.
They were at the alternative, some of them.
Okay. You're more up to date than I am then.
But you probably know more about the repression, because at the Guelaguetza, it was just rumors coming that they would announce, but we didn't quite know what was happening up there.
Right. Well, the folks tried to, the people of Oaxaca tried to walk to demonstrate, march to El Fortin, which I personally don't know, but it's where the official Guelaguetza is held in order to hold a popular alternative Guelaguetza. You'll see that it's about 5 minutes, and you'll see that it starts out as a very, very peaceful march, but then it's violently repressed by the police force. So,
and it was just last night, right?
It was yesterday,
yesterday.
Sort of midday. It was midday, right? It was
midday.
Happening when we were, because
we
got there around
gas
noon.
Smoke.
Oh, it's Mal de Ojo. Good for them.
What is Mal de Ojo?
Mal de Ojo is they do videos. I guess they're Oaxacans that do videos for Oaxaca so they can really spread the news.
Done, right?
Yeah.
We heard about them at the.
We saw the.
Unitierra,
we saw the really good video of theirs.
While we're waiting, what is
CIEPAC is the Center for Economic and Political Investigation for Community Action.
They're saying 214, 14's the name of that amphitheater that's up on the hill that we passed.
Fireworks.
lots of fireworks. That's the name of the amphitheater. There was a lot of people. It wasn't just a few. There's three of us that didn't go to Oaxaca, and but seven of us did.
Seven?
Mm-hmm. Seven of us were in Oaxaca, and three of you were not.
Well, we have two groups today. We have your group, and then we have some additional visitors. Ashley and Aaron were here yesterday.
I'm Abigail.
Oh, Abigail and Aaron.
And Ashley and Ellie.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's confusing.
And Abigail sent me a note asking if a couple of friends could join us today. And so I said they obviously good is not big enough to occupy all the space. So
thank you for having us.
Oh, no, it's a great pleasure. Does anybody want to present your group, where you're from, what your interests are, et cetera? And I'll give a little introduction to Sirbak and myself.
Well, I can present us. We are MITF, Marin Interfaith Task Force on the Americas, near San Francisco, California. And mostly our group does, well, we started out as a Central America, a group working on against U.S. intervention in Central America in the 80s.
Okay.
So the group is 25 or 30 years old. And it was actually started as an interfaith group. Now it doesn't have much to do with that, but we've sort of, it used to be Marin Interfaith Task Force on Central America, and then we changed it to Marin Interfaith Task Force on Mexico, Central America, Mexico, and the Caribbean, and now we're changing them again to
the Americas.
Okay.
Because
we've
been to Venezuela, Brazil, but anyway, we're in solidarity with social movements, including the immigrant movement in the United States.
And
I'd like to say that I belong, and Pauline and I belong to Global Justice. I'll leave the one here with you. You know it?
No, I've heard of Global
Exchange.
It's in
San Miguel de Allende.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Mexico.
Yeah, I think I have heard. Somebody from Global Justice has been here. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Anyway, MITF is leading, has organized this group, but people are from many different organizations
that
are in it.
I just thought that would be interesting for you.
Do you want to do very quickly, just go around, tell me, are you all then from the Bay Area, obviously?
No.
Why don't we do quickly, go around?
Betsy from San Miguel de Allende.
Okay, great.
Hi, Dale Sanderson from Marin County, California.
Okay.
Colleen Rose, Marin County, California as well.
Thank you.
And
Colleen Rose, and I'm from half the time in San Miguel in Mexico, the other half in the Bay Area.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Carrie, from Madison, Wisconsin.
Okay.
And I'm Carol. I'm from Marin County.
Okay.
And MIT.
Thank you.
Sure.
Tell us about yourself.
Okay, my name is Erin, and I am a master's student in geography and ecology in Europe. And I'm here doing research on my master's thesis for looking at political ecology of water privatization in the city.
Thank you.
My name's Mark. I live in Madison, Wisconsin.
Okay.
I'm Walter. I live in Davis, California. It's about 80 miles from San Francisco.
Davis. Yeah, that's there's a university there, right?
Yes.
UC Davis,
UC
right?
Davis.
Yeah. Okay. Good.
And your name is Miguel?
Yeah, Miguel Picard. That's how I pronounce it.
Does
anybody know how
what
to...
About these girls?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, sorry.
You don't count at all.
I'm Abigail Andrews.
Yeah.
And I'm here doing research for my master's thesis also on the relationships between the Zapatista movement and the organizations that support the movement. And Ashley is my roommate from college, and this is her friend, and they're just here for a few days visiting, but they're interested in social issues. So
and I've been living in Cuernavaca for the past 4 months doing volunteer work, so I see what's growing here.
Does anybody know about these projectors? Just to get them on fan, is it just once there? And then before you turn it off, leave it on fan, right?
Oops, I did the wrong thing. Sometimes you have to push them once and sometimes push them twice.
Okay, so we'll leave that there for a second till it cools down.
That's pretty exciting to see.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's see. Let me tell you a little bit about CIEPAC. First, about myself. I am the son of American parents who migrated against the grain, if you will. When my parents came to Mexico in the early 50s. It was an entirely different Mexico City. That's where they went on their honeymoon. And they loved it so much that they decided to stay. And my sister and I were born in Mexico City. So my sister, we both had dual nationality. My sister chose American nationality, went to live in the United States, married an American, has 5 kids, not at all interested about in Mexico, have nothing to do with Mexico, not in the least bit interested. But I remained basically most of my life here in Mexico and kept my Mexican nationality. When we turned 18, you had to choose.
Mm-hmm.
You were bi-national, bi-national or dual citizen until you're 18, and at that point you had to make a choice,
one or the other.
What
country said that?
Both countries said that.
Okay.
Both countries said that. The situation may be a bit different, I don't know.
I think it is.
Right? It is different for Mexicans born in Mexico who have migrated to the United States. The Mexican Congress has now granted them permission because of all the closure of social services to non-citizens in the United States. The Mexican Congress passed a measure that said, okay, if there are Mexicans living in the United States and they opt for American nationality, they do not lose their Mexican nationality, they retain their full rights here. Okay? Before, if they were opting for American nationality, they then had to lose all of their rights, and especially property rights, here in Mexico. So, where do we begin? There's so much to talk about. Most of you are activists, right? And most of you know about the globalization issues, I guess, right? And you know about NAFTA. Do you know about the link between NAFTA and migration? Right. You do. Yes.
2 million agricultural workers were out of jobs because of the subsidized corn.
Right, exactly.
And we've been distributing your thing that you wrote anyway about about
one?
Migration.
This one?
The one that's in English.
Mesoamerican
I believe that's
migrants
it. It's a couple of years old, right?
Yeah. Oh, I had some more comments then. That has a very, very important quote that I'll get to in a second. Yes?
Yeah, I would be really interested, and people can disagree, obviously, in your sense of sort of where Mexico is. Let's begin last summer with the election of Calderon. And where it's going, where you see, I mean, I just have this feeling that it's going to explode. And I want, and since you are such a brilliant analyst in so many ways, I'd really like to hear from you about what you think of that. I mean, you know, Oaxaca is obviously a sign. And I recently was at a Latin America Solidarity Coalition conference in Chicago in which a professor, I can't remember his name, but he was a professor at the UNAM and mentioned that there are 26 armed groups in Mexico, and he commented that Mexico was at its worst in 25 years in terms of democracy. So I don't know.
Okay. What else? Just call out your topics of interest, and you're included as well, and so I can more or less see where I'm going to go in the talk and maybe try to structure it. I have a structured talk, but I think most of you have know most of what I'm going to say, so maybe your topics of preference would be best, and I'll try to talk to all of the points that you are interested in.
I'd like to hear about your group. And what it does.
Okay.
It's like glue.
Anybody else? Preferences?
Organization.
I'd be interested in hearing about kind of the status of the Zapatistas and La Otra Campaña.
Okay.
And their relations to other groups.
Zapatistas and the other campaign, LOC in Spanish, La Otra Campaña.
I mean, I'm interested in anything related to water, anything that you could include in there. I mean, I'm particularly looking at the confluence of, global practices and local experience, and not only that, but San Cristobal is slightly different than a lot of the other parts of Mexico in terms of the water laws, so I'm also interested in that. But I don't know if that's too outside of.
We'll probably make some references, general references to privatization and those sorts of things.
That's really interesting to me too, I think.
Okay.
And where is Coca-Cola
on that
and other things? Yeah.
Okay.
On the Zapatistas, maybe just a little bit more if you have a sense of where the movement broadly is going here.
Okay.
Maybe more broadly where popular movements that we as solidarity activists would be want to ally with, where you think they might be going, and maybe what the important issues are for them that we should be aware of or be paying attention to.
If you get a chance,
chance to explain what these explosions are? Like, that woke me up this morning and...
Well, that's an easy one.
Okay.
The city is divided into barrios, and every barrio has a church, and every church has its saints, plural. And all of the saints have their day. So some church, some place is celebrating some saint.
Okay.
And there's fireworks going off all day. Yeah, that's what it is. Nothing to be afraid of. Should we start there and see where it takes us?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let's start out with CIEPAC. Again, CIEPAC is the Center for Economic and Political Investigation for Community Action. And that last part of our name, for community action, is the most important part, because when we founded CIEPAC in 1998, we felt that there was a need among grassroots organizations of all kinds for information and analysis. There are all kinds of activist groups like your own, but most of them in Chiapas are located in the countryside. And even when they're in the city, the access to information, and especially information that would be relevant to them, is practically nil. Okay? And if you've gone out to the countryside, either in Oaxaca or here, you know there is nothing out there. Huh? No books, no magazines, no newspapers, very little radio and television. And what mass media does get out there is controlled by the state to a large extent, or by a duopoly, two very large television networks that control about 80 to 90% of all viewing throughout Mexico. Okay? So you get, in the mass media, basically two viewpoints. It's either the government line or the private sector that's promoting its own agenda. But where's the news and information about what people are doing, what
mm-hmm.
grassroots organizations are doing? Where's the information that they need to be able to, very importantly, make decisions? Well, exactly what you're asking me. How can we tie in from Marin County? How can we tie in to other things that are happening? Well, that grassroots organizations don't have access to. Okay? So CIEPAC was founded on that premise that there's a need to get information and analysis to the grassroots organizations. And how this works is that the organizations come and ask us, and typically we'll say, next week in the rural community we're having an assembly meeting. Come talk to us in the morning for a couple of hours about, and they will fill in the blank. And they may ask just to be brought up to date since the last assembly 3 months ago. In other words, current events. What has happened in Chiapas, in Mexico, and in the world in the past 3 months that may be interesting for us to know about? Or they may ask for a specific topic. Okay, so that's our task. And we do these talks out wherever the grassroots organizations ask us to go. And then we produce materials, and I'll just show you some of them, from very simple, easy to read booklets and pamphlets, lots of cartoon stuff, makes it more enjoyable, but relatively in-depth information. For example, this is a book on the Plan Pueblo Panama. If you haven't heard of the PPP, well, it's something very important here. We're doing
Latin Oaxaca.
Pardon?
We heard about it in Latin Oaxaca.
Okay.
In the Isthmus especially.
Mm-hmm. We're trying to gradually do more and more audiovisual material. And this is a DVD on the Plan Pueblo of Panama. Mm-hmm. And we did another one recently on the other campaign. This one, we would like to translate it into English for other groups around the world that are interested in what's happening in the other campaign. We did a booklet, this is in Spanish and English, on the Boycott Coca-Cola campaign. This is our tie-in to a worldwide Boycott Coca-Cola campaign. And all kinds of other things, all kinds of, and some fairly in-depth studies. Like, for example, in the steps of an unconcluded war. This is Onesimo, my companion here in Siapac, did this. This is the result of an investigation of over 4 years about what the military is doing, all kinds of very detailed maps, etc. So this is what we do. This is this, for example, is the military post in Chiapas from 2005 until February of 2006. And so, well, very, very in-depth, excellent, excellent work. So that's what we do. Question often comes up, how are you funded? We're funded by foundations and agencies in the United States, Canada, and Europe. Okay? What else? Last, can I tell you? That's it. Yes?
I'm wondering about, you know, I know a lot of journalists in Mexico are very fearful because they have to be careful what they print or what they report on. And I'm thinking these are sensitive subjects that you're reporting on. Is this, are you in danger? Have you had threats?
We just very recently, for the first time, last February, we received our first overt death threat.
Okay? Yeah.
It has not been something that's common to us. Okay, there are other groups. Just the powers that be have not considered non-governmental organizations, NGOs like our own, to really be that big of a threat. Mm-hmm. There has been a change in Mexico in the past 18 months. And could you snap on this light here? Thank you. There has been a change in Mexico in the past 18 months, and we think that those changes have to do with this death threat that we received, and also some other suspicious activity related to CIEPAC people, particularly in their homes. Mm-hmm. There have been unusual circumstances there in their homes, and as I say, the overt death threat came last February. So yes, as a matter of fact, you hit on a topic that's very, very sensitive. Mexico, if I'm not mistaken, is the second most dangerous country for you to be a journalist.
Right, that's, yes.
Wow.
Second to Colombia?
In the world?
No, second to Iraq.
Iraq.
Yeah.
It's Iraq.
Not even Colombia?
Not even Colombia. Not even Colombia. That's... The news I've heard is that Mexico is number two on the list. It's the second most dangerous country to be a journalist in.
In terms of how many have been killed? Or
yes.
Hurt?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
There's a new group in San Miguel on that. You know about that?
No.
Another
group
that's...
The
journalists that are fighting this.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. Okay.
So what's the change in the last 18 months?
Yeah.
Or are you going to...
Yeah, should we go right in there?
Mexico since
2006. All right. Well, and this will tie in with the Zapatistas. And let me see if I can remember. I sometimes struggle with the dates. In 2003, if I'm not mistaken, you being people in the Solidarity Movement. Is this when the Caracoles were formed?
Yes.
Okay. In August of 2003, Agosto 2003, the Caracoles, one Caracol and two Caracoles, and this is means what? Means
snail,
or it means a shell, and it may. It's also making reference to the shell of the snail, right? The shell that the snail pulls into, okay? And this symbol, right, this spiral symbol, is very, very important in the indigenous culture. And the indigenous people that are within the Zapatista movement use this word to identify a new phase of the Zapatista movement. Mm-hmm. And what it was was a decision on the part of these Zapatistas in general to undertake a devolution of power and authority from the military structure, and that's the EZLN, Zapatista Army of National Liberation, to the people, to the base, to the Zapatista base, the civilians, if you will, of the Zapatista movement, okay? So there's an armed wing, which is the EZLN, and then there's the civilians that are also Zapatistas, but they're not involved in the military aspect of the Zapatista movement. Okay?
And the clandestine committee, is that part, that's the EZLN, those are
right.
The comandantes, but
yeah,
they're not.
These are the comandantes that are
but
here.
They're very civilian.
No.
Well, like Ramona, she was.
No, but they're within
they're
the
not.
Military structure.
Okay.
Okay, and what is the military structure means that you respond in a vertical way, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like any other army, very top down, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's the comandantes at the top. Marcos is not even a comandante, he's a subcomandante. He takes the order from the clandestine indigenous committee, right? So it's military. And since the Zapatista uprising in January of 1994, it was the EZLN that was basically making all decisions for all of the Zapatista supporters. Okay, whether they be military decisions or non-military civilian decisions, the EZLN structure was making all important decisions. Well,
pero obedeciendo.
Mandar obedeciendo, right.
Yeah.
That, yes. You're making reference to one of the main Zapatista slogans, right? Which is very difficult to translate. Obedeciendo. It means to lead by obeying. Okay? Yes. You are entrusted with power. You are given a mandate to lead, but you must obey the will of the people. So, mandar obedeciendo. And that's been one of the main Zapatista tenets since January of 1994. Okay, so in August of 2003, the Caracoles come into existence. And let me just explain that the Zapatistas are structured as follows. There's a community level, right? All kinds of hundreds of communities throughout. What is Zapatista land? Zapatista land is more or less the eastern, half of Chiapas. Where this is San Cristobal, so you can basically say from San Cristobal east, that's Zapatista area of influence, okay? So, and important to note is that not all communities are fully Zapatistas. Some of them are, but then there are other communities that are mixed, and there are some communities where the Zapatistas are in very definitely a minority, okay? So, a number of communities come together and they form a autonomous municipality. Okay, and then there are about 30 some odd, 32 autonomous municipalities, and then these a number of autonomous municipalities come together and they form a caracol. Okay, and each caracol, each center, has a good government council, or in Spanish, Junta de Buen Gobierno. Okay? And so this is the structure. This is the structure. This is a civilian structure. It aspires to be. Okay? I can't say it's 100% run by civilians, because the military, the EZLN, still plays a role here. Okay? Now, how much depends? Depends on what the situation is, how much repression is coming from the government, what the matter being dealt with, the different topics involve the military wing to a greater degree than others. But basically, people from the base rotate through this entire structure, and they rotate through fairly frequently. As a matter of fact, Marcos, 1 year after August 2003, did a one-year evaluation, and he said, this has been a problem. We have had all kinds of complaints, especially from foreign delegations who come and want to establish a relationship with us, and they come to the Caracol, and they meet people, and things begin to happen, and then we rotate the people out, and then the delegation comes back 3 or 4 months later and finds a totally different group of people, and nobody knows what happened 3 or 4 months before. So he said, we recognize that this is one of our faults, this is one of our weak points. However, we think it's an advantage. In spite of this disadvantage, we think it's an advantage for people to be rotating through, because it gives folks a hands-on experience in governing. In governing, right? And we don't want there to be a political class. Okay? We don't want there to be professional politicians. Why? Well, they can be very easily corrupted, and they sometimes tend to stray from the needs of the base. And that's, we don't want that. We want people that are our government to lead, but by obeying. And if you have a political, professional political class, that sometimes does not happen. Okay? All right, well, that's this. Okay, 2 years almost to the month, not quite, but in June, if I'm not mistaken, of 2005, Zapatistas declare a red alert and cause all kinds of commotion everywhere, especially to folks around the world that follow the Zapatistas. Okay, what is this business about the red alert? And it looked like something military was in the offing. And when the red alert came out, we were all very perplexed and said, okay, Zapatistas, the Zapatistas have traditionally not wanted to undertake offensive military activity. They're in a defensive mode. They haven't laid down their guns and are not going to do so. But they have said to the Mexican people, we are not going to go on the offensive. We're not going to turn in our weapons as the government wants, because our weapons are our symbol of our decision to resist to the very end. In other words, the government is going to have to come in and kill us off, because to defend ourselves, we will take up arms. Okay. So this red alert is published in a communique, and it sounds very, very militaristic. So we say, okay, well, maybe the Zapatistas have heard something about the Mexican government. There's some movement with the army. Perhaps the army is planning something. And so we were all on tenterhooks, okay. And this was the announcement. What came out of this was the sixth declaration of the Lacandon jungle. Okay, there have been six to date. The first was on January 1st, 1994. These are major policy declarations on the part of the Zapatistas. And the sixth declaration of the Lacandon jungle said to the Mexican people and to folks around the world that the Zapatistas were going to go beyond this, that this was great. There had been progress in consolidating all kinds of autonomous activity. What does autonomous mean here? Activity apart from the government. Like, for example, education, health, growing crops, selling any sorts of products that are made within the Zapatista community. This was all being done autonomously, unfortunately not outside of the market, the capitalist market, because that's impossible at this point, but certainly being done with no government participation, especially in those very, very critical areas of education and health. The Zapatistas were doing these things on their own to a great extent. In health, we always have to put an asterisk and say, well, okay, where do the vaccines for the children come from? Well, they come from the government.
Sure.
They're routed through NGOs, but they come basically from the government's health sector. And that's been an exception, and it's deemed to be okay. I mean, it would be impossible to vaccinate children against so many diseases and to sacrifice them just to make a point that they don't want to be associated with the government would be foolish. Okay. So the Zapatistas say in the sixth declaration of the Lacandon Jungle, we are going to go beyond this because we feel that we are consolidating, as Zapatistas, we are consolidating, and that's great. And we are going to continue to consolidate our particular model of doing things, our model of autonomy. But we need to go beyond. Not to take our model of doing things to the rest of Mexico. Because our model is for here, for Chiapas. It's not a model for Marin County. It's not a model for Mexico City or Madison, Wisconsin. No. But what we do want to take first to Mexico and then eventually gradually to areas outside of Mexico is a way of doing things, okay? It's an example of what needs to be done, but just an example. And we would hope that our example would inspire people in different walks of life, in different areas, to also undertake this very, very important principle of autonomy. And sometimes when I give this talk, well, we have some here to university students, I say, well, you're, where are you, Abigail?
UC Berkeley.
UC Berkeley, okay. Well, there you go. That's a space. And this is a just like this space, the Zapatistas have in many ways won a space in which to carry out their autonomous project. Well, how about that space called UC Berkeley?
Novartis, what's the other one that's just getting
What
on?
Could you, why don't you implement an autonomous university there?
It's run by the government.
Well, there you go. There's a good place.
And financed by the corporations.
Who's running UC Berkeley? Generally, they're called regents,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Regents. Well, who are
there's
those
petroleum
regents?
Petroleum now, too.
Yeah, they're
there's a whole lot of corporations.
Corporations and politicians. And well, what if the students, the professors, and the administrative workers ran UC Berkeley, made the important decisions? What if they had a Congress at Berkeley, right? These are the types of ideas that the Zapatistas think that are important to take out. And this was going to be through the other campaign, La Otra Campaña. And the sixth declaration talked about launching the other campaign. Okay? And does everybody know about the other campaign? What is that about? Have you talked about it within your group?
I asked everybody to read a book about the sixth declaration.
Okay.
I assume people did.
I have.
Before this
very,
trip.
Very quickly make reference to the other campaign.
Yeah.
Okay. The other campaign says, the following. The other campaign is a campaign to take the example, not the model, the example of the Zapatistas to the rest of Mexico. So the Zapatistas said, we want to meet with organized folks wherever they may be in Mexico. If they want to meet with us, we will make an effort to go out and meet with you. And the first phase of the other campaign was just to sit down and listen to everybody. What a radical notion, to sit down and listen. So the Zapatistas were not, at the beginning, carrying any particular message. Their task was to sit down and to, all right, there's a group someplace in Yucatan that's having a particular problem. Is it a problem with water? Is it a problem with the high cost of electricity? Is it a problem with lands being expropriated? Whatever. The Zapatistas, Marcos, and some of the comandantes traveled to different places and actually made their way all the way up north, with a long, long pause in the Mexico City area in May of last year because of the terrible repression against Atenco. And that's a whole nother ball of wax, okay? All right, so again, let me come back to this radical idea of sitting down and listening to people and their problems. Why is that so radical? Well, here we have to make reference to the name, The Other Campaign. Why The Other Campaign? What are they counter what? What's the rest of it?
Well, the regular election campaign.
Exactly, right. The regular election campaign. The regular election campaign was kicking in to force right at the time that the Zapatistas come out with the sixth declaration of the Lacandon Jungle. Why? Because in July 2006, exactly July 2nd, 2006, there was a presidential election. Okay, so our campaign, not officially, but extra officially, unofficially, kicks in a year before the actual, and actually 13 months. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people would say, well, even more, right? Longer before the actual election date. So everybody's going into election mode, right? The parties are naming their candidates, or they're naming their nominees to be the candidate for their particular party, and their banners and posters going up all throughout Mexico, and the ads are beginning on television. And the Zapatistas say, hey, wait a minute. We've got the other campaign, and there's some important differences. Well, what are some of those differences? Well, first of all, the Zapatistas come and sit down with the particular group and listen, which is radically different than what the candidates do. They just come and make a big pompous speech and then leave. And don't listen to what's going on locally. They're not interested, actually. They're not interested. Okay? And what is something that the politicians bring? Well, maybe it's not true in American politics. What is it that the politicians bring that the Zapatistas could not bring?
Promises.
Handouts.
Yes.
Little gifts.
Yes.
Etc. The Zapatistas say, we don't have any of that. Mm-hmm. We're not making any promises. No. And we're certainly not giving gifts. As a matter of fact, the local groups, when they wanted to talk with the Zapatistas, actually had to fund their presence. They had to pay for the gasoline and, you know, put out the food and, okay? Radically different. Radically different. But in addition, the Zapatistas went further and they said, okay, folks, we're calling this the other campaign because we want you to look past those blankety-blank elections. We don't need elections. We need radical structural change. And no candidate, no matter who he or she is, and there was a woman candidate for president, if they're within the system, they're not going to bring radical change. Impossible. So Mexican people, get real. Look past the elections. Don't even pay attention. What difference does it make? They're all going to defend elite interests anyway. It doesn't matter if they're slightly to the right or slightly to the left. They're going to represent and defend elite interests. Is it true? Well, of course it's true. And the Zapatistas pointed to all kinds of examples. They said, well, let's take a look at our, quote, left party, the party of the Democratic Revolution. Oh, and you can heap so much stuff on the PRD that it's not funny. And the Zapatistas were right. There's all kinds. It is a, quote, leftist party. It was formed in 1989 after another enormous fraudulent election the year before. And the PRD has strains of different left groups all over the spectrum of the left. Okay? And as a matter of fact, they even have people coming into the PRD from the arch rival and horribly corrupt PRI. Okay? The PRI is the party that governed in Mexico at the presidential level for 71 long years, okay? And some of the people in the PRI, well, as a matter of fact, the founders of the PRD are renegades from the PRI, okay? But the PRD did bring in, like, for example, the remnants of the Mexican Communist Party and the Socialist Workers Party, okay? So, all kinds of currents in the PRD lead to all kinds of infighting and all kinds of contradictions, and well, it is a mess, but it is our, quote, leftist party. Okay? So, the Zapatistas say, come on, get real. You're going to go vote for the PRD? This is absurd. Well, the only problem is that the PRD fielded an extremely popular candidate called Mr. AMLO. These are the initials to his name. His name is Andrés Manuel López Obrador. Okay, but let's just refer to him as Mr. AMLO, as the Mexican press does. Okay, Mr. AMLO was the mayor of Mexico City, and he became extremely popular, not just with the residents of Mexico City, but word about what he had done, his very simple lifestyle, the fact that everybody else tried to catch him in any sort of contradiction or any sort of act of corruption, and they were unable to do it. He seems to be, oh my God, the most rare of species in Mexico, an uncorrupt politician. Okay? And he drives as well, not while he was Mexico City, but he drove a very simple car, lived in, no, not a big mansion, but in an apartment in Mexico City, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. Well, and the president during all this time was a guy called Fox, right? And Mr. Fox tried to defame him and tried to heap all sorts of abuse on AMLO in an effort to keep him from getting on the ballot. In the end, Fox was unsuccessful, and Mr. AMLO got onto the ballot, okay? Mr. AMLO was so popular, that everybody on the left said, he's a shoo-in. Mm-hmm. He's going to be our next president. The left's turn is here. We've had this horribly corrupt PRI party. We've had Mr. Fox from his PAN, National Action Party, in for 6 years. Now it's the left's turn. Well, with this, Sub-Commander Marcos began to heap all kinds of abuse on Mr. AMLO. More on Mr. AMLO than on the PRD.
Why?
He called Mr. AMLO the worse. He's worse than the PRI, right? And see, the problem,
that's
the problem
I never
here
understood.
Was that the Zapatistas thought that Mr. AMLO was going to be the winner on July 2nd. He was going to be the president for the next 6 years. Were they right? Were they wrong? Well, they were right in the sense that he did, Mr. AMLO was elected, but he's not the president. Why? Because there was fraud committed on July 2nd. Enormous fraud. Fraud previous to election day, on election day, and then the days and weeks following to keep him from becoming president. Okay? So most Mexicans believe that Mr. AMLO is the legitimate president. And they make a differentiation between the legitimate president and the legal president, which is from Mr. Fox's PAN party called Felipe Calderon. So in something that the, in a situation, a scenario that is reminiscent to what happened in the United States, right? Where who was it? Is it Gore?
It was Gore and then
Gore?
Nader
and Bush.
And everybody, yeah, was saying, "Oh, you voted for Nader, so therefore that's why Gore didn't win." Just like they say, "Look what Marcos did, and that's why
the Nader factor is missing here. The Nader factor is missing. But what when Mr. AMLO is unsuccessful in reaching the presidency, and he had millions of people demonstrating in Mexico City. I mean, and I'm not exaggerating. Literally millions of people came out and demonstrated in favor of Mr. AMLO after the fraudulent July 2nd elections. He was unable to obtain what his main demand was, for there to be a vote-by-vote recount. The Electoral Tribunal turned aside that and decided to only count 10% of the electoral packets. Okay? And with that, well, Mr. Calderon took office on December 1st, 2006. Should I take questions or should I finish? Yeah, why don't we take a question from you and then we'll come over here.
Just a quick one. You said that the Zapatistas were sure that AMLO was going to win, and you sort of connected that to their Marcos blasted AMLO. In
uh-huh.
other words, it was safe to blast AMLO? Is that what you're saying? Because he was going to win?
Because it wouldn't make him lose.
In other words, he was going to win anyway, so blasting him, thereby discouraging people to vote for
That's
him, wouldn't matter?
Well, what he said was, see, everybody's convinced in this mindset AMLO's the next president. What is AMLO going to do as president? Well, he's going to do basically what he did when he was mayor of Mexico City, was to hand out some more money to the people. Okay? Yes, and Mr. AMLO did that. He took care of the elderly. He gave them an additional $70 stipend. He built schools. He founded a new university in Mexico City. He funded the arts. He did all kinds of lefty things, which the people on the right are not disposed to do. See, the people on the right, what are they doing? They're closing all of those things, privatizing them, right? Well, here's AMLO, a patron of the arts, promoting schools, promoting education, promoting health, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and the Zapatistas, well, particularly Marcos says, see, what this does is it doesn't attack the root causes of our problems here in Mexico. Okay? AMLO, yeah, he's going to hand out a little bit more money. And what he's going to do is he's going to demobilize the people. Because instead, the people, instead of pressing on with their demands, they're going to get a little money from Mr. AMLO as president, and they're going to go home. Okay? Yeah, sure, and it's happened. I know of all kinds of examples. People out there demonstrating, the government says, oh, that program, yeah, what you were protesting against, I have now decreed it's abolished. And the people go home. Now, what's been abolished is the name of the program, but the activities continue regardless. Right around the Plan Puebla Panama, this happened in the state of Puebla. People were up in arms about the Puebla version of the Plan Puebla Panama. It's called the Millennium Project. So the governor said, I hereby decree the end of the Millennium Project. And people went home. But all of the activities continued with no label, right? So these things happen. People do get demobilized. If you're up in arms because there's no potable water, no drinking water in your community, well, you know, give them $500 and let them get a pump well, and sometimes people will stop protesting. I mean, that's what they came together for, to get some water, right? Okay, so Marco says, folks, again, look beyond elections. It's not a matter of just getting a little bit more money and oiling the squeaky wheel. We need real structural change. And that means inverting the whole pyramid of power. We're a tiny, tiny elite of billionaires and foreign, mostly American, multinational corporations control everything. Okay? Why don't we invert the triangle? That's what we need to do. Forget about elections. Forget about Mr. AMLO. Mr. AMLO is not going to invert that triangle. Let's get real, folks.
He said he'd renegotiate NAFTA.
He said he would renegotiate NAFTA, but actually, we should give NAFTA a swift kick,
get rid of NAFTA.
And get rid of it, and then sit down on a different set of principles with Americans and Canadians and say, well, is there a fair trade agreement that we can all agree on that would benefit the people and not just the multinational corporations, as is the case with NAFTA now, okay? Mr. AMLO was going to, try to get a particular portion of NAFTA renegotiated. And that's the whole agricultural sector. Why? Because the agricultural sector is affecting the most vulnerable part of our population, which are the poor peasants, most of them indigenous peasants, that are dying out there or having to migrate to the cities or to the United States. Okay? How are we doing on time? Why don't we have a 5-minute break? Does that sound okay? Should we take a 5-minute break? Stretch our legs, have some coffee. There's more tea. More tea was made in the kitchen if you'd like some more. The bathroom, by the way, if you go through the kitchen, turn right, it's the first door on your right. So let's go. 5 minutes.
Well, see, it seems like he was... that all makes sense, but... He was attacking Emma. What? I mean, it seemed like a personal vendetta.
2010.
1910. Yeah.
Anywhere.
Can I just shut the back door?
Yeah, right.
Podemos empezar, damas y caballeros.
Thank you, Mark. Keeping me in line.
Okay, so where were we? Yes.
Inverted pyramids. I think that's where we left off.
Inverted pyramids. Well, that's what it's about, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Also, the Zapatistas say something about what needs to here. Where the movement is going, where the Zapatista movement is going, is the following. Zapatistas have a very, very important principle, and they say, we do not want to take power. We do not want to become president, governor, mayor. First of all, because that's participating within the system, and as we've already seen, working within the system is not going to invert that pyramid. But second of all, inverting the pyramid is about something totally different. And it's already been tried. Storming the Winter Palace is the, right? It's the, that's the, what is that like? The emblematic expression of all of this, right? What the Bolsheviks did in the Russian Revolution, right? They stormed the Winter Palace and took power, right? Well, the liberation movements, although the Zapatistas call themselves a liberation movement, the liberation movements in Latin America have basically tried that, right? Yeah. To take power by force, storming the Winter Palace, if you will, and except for the Cuban Revolution, they have failed.
Right.
So the Zapatistas say, well, it's obvious that that's not the way. Mm-hmm. Right? Principally because the United States won't permit
right.
that to occur.
You can't succeed, that's why. It's
in this
way.
Hemisphere, right? In this hemisphere, that's not going to happen until the United States radically changes.
Right.
So what we have to do is organize from the bottom up. Okay? Now, it's not a question of just taking this pinnacle. We have to actually work from the bottom. If we can organize folks, if we can get everybody on a certain frequency, on a wavelength, if we can get people working at the grassroots to organize, that's the way. Okay? And just to explain this in a little bit more detail, Marcos said by way of example, he said, during the early days of the other campaign, we visited quite a number of communities on the Pacific coast of Chiapas, where once and all, time and time again, people that we met with in organizations said, we have banded together in our little communities here to fight against the high electricity tariffs. We've waited for 50 years for light to finally come into our village. They bring in light, and we hang a little bulb in our hut, and we get hit with a $25 bill the following month, right? And sometimes it's $90 or $120. And this story was told to Marcos one in several times during his tour on the coast.
Dollars or pesos?
Well, I'm changing it into dollars, no? I said $25, so 200 and some odd pesos. Okay.
Huh.
So, yeah, 200, 600, 900 pesos.
Because it used to be very cheap. I remember people I knew that were campesinos, they hardly paid anything for electricity. And we had to pay more. The foreigners had to pay more for electricity than the people from the pueblo.
Well,
I remember. But this is all changed? It's all changed?
Yeah. Well, I mean, relative to income, relative to income.
Right.
Suppose that you pay $10 for a light bill. That doesn't sound much in America.
No, it's
terms,
a lot.
But for a campesino, $10 is a lot of money. So
exactly.
Relative to income, electricity rates are very high. And what is the reason for that? Well, because since the early 80s, there's been this whole neoliberal mentality that subsidies are bad. So maybe the light rates used to be subsidized by the government. Well, subsidies have been slowly erased, and in some cases they're down to zero, right? So yeah, people are paying a whole lot more than they used to, and so they've organized, right? And they've had a number of groups here. So what Marco said is, okay, well, you've taken the first step. And that's to organize with your neighbors around a particular demand. That's fantastic. Good, that's the first step. Second step is, how about another group up the coast? Would you down here in the Tapachula area be willing to work with groups that are doing the same thing in close to Arriaga, up here, close to the border with Oaxaca? If you are, And you can link in some way and join your struggles and also the struggles of other similar organizations up and down the coast. Hey, maybe you can make some sort of an organization like the Chiapas Pacific Coast Movement Against High Electricity Rates. That's the second step. Okay. And now, how about with the folks that are at the other end of Mexico who are in exactly the same struggle? Are you willing to link with them and coordinate your struggles and activities with folks that are thousands of kilometers away? If so, hey, then we have a fantastic national movement going that maybe we can begin to undertake real change. Maybe we can pressure from the bottom up, we can pressure the government to concede to the lower income sectors special low tariffs. Okay? And then there's another step. Well, why stop with high electricity rates? Why don't we do this around any of a number of major pressing issues? And hey, we've got whole national movements going, and that's the way to transform the country. Because you see, that's been the history of Mexico, is okay, yeah, there are protest movements, but they're unlinked or delinked from things going on in other parts of the country. And the whole Apo and Oaxaca protest movement last year was a perfect case in point. I mean, this was, as I said, near insurrectional?
No, it was.
That movement was close to an insurrection. Why do I call it an insurrection? Because it wasn't the hardcore lefties that were out there. Yes, they were out there. But so were grandmothers, and so was the corner fruit vendor, and so were grade school kids. They were out there. This tremendous wide panorama of Oaxacan society was out on the street protesting to get rid of this horribly corrupt governor called Ulises Ruiz. And not only that, Apo had control of the city. Through their blockades, they had prevented unwanted traffic from getting into the center, and as a matter of fact, they were taking on certain rudimentary functions of government. Government being run by the people. Okay? And they had prevented the standing government from going into their government offices and doing governmental type things. They were taking care of some of the city's functions, security, garbage collection, etc. Okay? The people, neighbors. And that's why the powers that be were so anxious to stamp out the Apo and the whole Oaxacan movement, okay? It was near insurrection.
So do you think AMLO would have been so anxious to stamp it out?
Very interesting question. Very interesting question. I don't know. He didn't say much about the whole Oaxaca movement, right? Because this was going on right in the lead up to the election. So he was afraid of being branded by the far right as an anarchist and allowing chaos. But let me go back to my original point. This was a tremendous, one of the most important and widespread movements in the recent history of Mexico. But it went unanswered and virtually unsupported in the rest of Mexico. Started out with the teachers union, right? Protesting, and it grew from there. And sure, some of the teachers union local offices in other parts of the country joined in, but basically, when it went past the teachers union, the rest of Mexico did not respond. Some young people did. And that's, hey, great. Great for the young people. And they went to Oaxaca and they supported and they were at the barricades and they did an awful lot of fantastic things. But you see, this has been a problem. So the other campaign said, hey, can we be of help in linking all of these struggles together and trying to get a national movement going? Long-range prospect? Yes, it's going to take a while. It is going to go beyond July 2nd, 2006. We're talking about, who knows? Maybe it'll be 10 years, 20 years, who knows? But there's no time limit. I mean, we've got a monumental task on our hands, organizing people from the bottom up. How long does that take? Well, where's the rule book? There's no rule book. It takes as long as it's going to take, and that's become sort of like a cliche expression, no? It's going to take as long as it's going to take. So, let's see, let's try to bring it all back. So, okay. Why was so much abuse heaped on AMLO as such? Well, again, because Marcos, I think this was basically a Marcos, and Carolina was asking me about this. This was basically Marcos' analysis of what was going to happen, right? He was going to demobilize, and he was going to postpone the need for people to eventually come together and do exactly what the Zapatistas proposed. How do I feel about this? I think the Zapatistas are right. They are totally right. So in the long run, what they say, what is right on. Okay? It's just that the short term is what fouled them up. Okay. The short term fouled them up. And what we have is, yes, elections on July 2nd. Yes, the majority did vote for AMLO, but he's not president. And instead, who came into office was a person, Felipe Calderón, who represents not only the right, but the far right. The Mexican equivalent to the neocons. Those are the people that are in power right now. These are, as a matter of fact, there's an organization called the Yunque.
Yes, somebody sent me that.
Yunque is a means anvil. Okay? Anvil. Like, you know, the thing that the
blacksmiths
used to pound on. And this is a far right, I would almost say fascist organization, and lots of people from the Yunque are in Mr. Calderón's government. So not only do we have the right, but we've got the neocons, our equivalent of the neocons in power, and they're extremely repressive, undemocratic, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. So what happens here? Well, while I get my breath, are there any questions, comments?
One.
Wow, you're getting this all down in a drawing.
Just the complexities of it.
The complexities of it. Yeah.
I would say that the feeling, and these people. Some of them speak Spanish, one's Guatemalan and was in the revolution and so on. The feeling of a lot of people in San Miguel is, because they talk to people all over, they have conferences and so on, is that there's things are seething in Mexico. Mm-hmm. Seething.
Right. Okay. All right, well, that ties into exactly.
What can the Zapatistas do? I mean,
well, this ties into
do you feel that way?
Yeah, very definitely. We're just a couple of days ago, CIEPAC is a member of a network here in Chiapas called Red Chiapaneca por la Paz, the Chiapas Network for Peace. And what it is, it's just a group of NGOs that meet periodically to basically sit around and analyze what's going on. we try to be, we try to do other things, but basically that's what we're doing. And these are some of the sheets left from our Tuesday or Wednesday brainstorming session last week. Tendencies. Police, military, state. More control. Weakening of our liberties, expression, information.
Sounds like the U.S.
Yes.
Unmeasurable increase in migration, above all from communities, indigenous and peasant campesino communities. In questions, social transformation, where has that been left?
Where should that go?
Yeah, social transformation, I was asked, what does that mean? Well, it means turning around the pyramid, basically. Okay, and then, this was somebody's idea. He was, I think, trying to be very provocative. He says, well, you know, yeah, there's lots of migration going on, but isn't that bringing modernity?
Right.
To indigenous communities?
Yeah, well, that's
modernizing communities. New ideas, capitalist ideas, normalizing the market. In other words, now what you call in the United States, mainstreaming the market. Right? And then, interesting. Somebody asked, where are the new generations? That's a worry. That's a worry. Where are the new generations? Because one guy sitting here says, you know, we've been meeting for an awful long time, and our NGO community in Chiapas is relatively small. We're basically the same people that meet, and I'm sure that happens in Marin County,
yes,
right? The people that are in the interfaith group are also participating in the anti-war things, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, the People's Food System was the same people as the Central America Solidarity Movement.
There you go.
Yeah.
Right.
But we got new young people lately.
Well, good.
A lot of people of color, young people of color.
And this guy was saying, you know, basically we're the same ones around the table. They're new people. But basically we're the same ones. We're just getting older and fatter. And where are the new generations? Are they really coming in? Are they really taking up where we're leaving off?
Maybe they're migrating.
Or maybe they're migrating, exactly. So this is what has come in with this far right. Now, what happens after July 2nd is that Calderon knows that he was not elected. He's not the legitimate president. Like Bush, exactly. And what does he do? The first thing that he does as president is that he raises the salary of the military. And he does something that no Mexican president has done basically since the Mexican Revolution's military phase, 1910 to 1920, is he puts on a military jacket.
Ah.
Khaki green at one of his first functions as a president.
Why would he do that?
Well, because he's so weak.
He
realizes he's not the legitimate president of Mexico. And he makes an explicit statement to the Mexican people by doing this.
Oh, right.
You get in my way. No? I am the commander-in-chief of the military, and you better watch out. And that has been the message that has been transmitted, basically, and even before July 2nd. I have a theory. The repression in Mexico took a turn for the worse, much worse, starting even before 2006. And what I feel is that generally what happens, our presidential terms are 6 years. In the final year, the standing lame duck president begins to lose really effectiveness and power. And whoever thinks he is going to be president begins to take that power. And I believe that the people from the Yunque began to influence President Fox and began to make some significant changes and, for example, repression against movements, and particularly against Atenco, and particularly against Oaxaca. Why? What happened? Well, the type of repression that we've not seen commonly in Mexico was unleashed. And there were qualitative changes. Right? There have been all kinds of things to militarize the country, all kinds of things. Increased budgets, increased Mexican cadets going to the School of the Americas to get prepared in torture and counterinsurgency techniques in the United States in Fort Benning, Georgia. Is that right? Yeah, okay. All kinds of things, all kinds of things. But a number of things began to happen, like, for example, the militarization of the police. Okay,
yeah.
So it's not just police that are out there beating people. It's the military that has been shifted into the police force.
Who trained the PFAP? Because they were doing just the same sorts of stuff as the military did in Central America.
Right. Well, they were trained by military personnel. And the military personnel is trained at Fort Benning, and so, yeah. But then, for example, the people detained in Atenco and the people detained in Oaxaca, a few things happened that were really radically different. First of all, we saw for the first time rape being used
as rape and torture.
Well, torture has always been there, but rape. Rape as a way of controlling people. And not only raping women, raping men, okay? As an effort to control, right? And let people know, this is what you are being subjected to. And then another thing, the people from Oaxaca, for example, were taken to prisons 1,000 kilometers away in the state of Nayarit, up here. So making it tremendously difficult. I mean, we're not talking about professional lefties who know that all kinds of horrible things are going to happen to them if they get caught. But I mean, we're talking about
ordinary people.
Again, the corner fruit vendor, okay, being taken to a prison, high security prison, placed in solitary confinement, 1,000 kilometers away from his or her family. Making it extremely difficult and costly for the family to follow up on that person's detention, bring that person a bit of food, a bit of comfort, etc. Imagine what it means for a poor family to travel 1,000 kilometers and pay for a hotel, and pay for meals, and da 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 da. Right? Well, these were messages that were being. I mean, I say that the right was jumping up and down in glee when the leftist press, like for example, here Proceso. I don't have a cover, but this is one of our. This is a Proceso is a weekly magazine, right? Yeah, I've got a couple of them. It's one of the most widely read magazines, and it's on the left. Well, they were splashing on their cover the gory photos of people having been beaten on the head. They're head split open, people lying on the ground, et cetera, et cetera. The far right was jumping up and down in glee. Yes, this is the message that we want to get across. Mm-hmm. There is going to be terrible repression visited on you if you so much as go out on the street corner and participate in any of these demonstrations. Okay? As bad and as corrupt as the pre had been during its 71 years in power, we had not seen things of this nature. The PRI has always been, they would prefer to sit down and try to buy off.
Right, financially.
But if they can't buy them, they murder them.
Right.
Or, what I called exactly right, in the sliding scale of repression. But murder was not the first option. as opposed to Central America, where, yeah, you left, you know, you're a trade union leader, off with your head. That was the first option. No, in Mexico, it's always been qualitatively a different story.
Right.
The government has always wanted to say, okay, you know, what's your beef? And at the end, if they couldn't buy him off, they couldn't neutralize the person, then if the person was important enough, he or she was murdered. Okay? But at least there was this transition, right? Which meant that a lot less people than in Central America were murdered in Mexico for being leaders of different sorts of movements and trade unions, et cetera, et cetera. Well, this changed. And it changed in the final year of Fox's 6-year term. And I believe that it's because these people from the far right now had greater influence. Right? And maybe even the control of the government to some extent. Who knows?
But how did they
it's a big black hole. They're called the Mexican government. And we don't really know what goes on in its interior. Okay. So that brings us to armed groups. Well, there has been a undoubted, I won't say flood of people into armed groups, right, guerrilla groups, but undoubtedly this has happened as especially young people have seen, hey, wait a minute, doors are being closed to protest, they're being closed to movements, social movements that are pressing for changes and trying to get the corrupt folks out and a little bit of honesty and decency into our government. This is all being closed off by the far right, so the only option is to go into a guerrilla group to pick up arms. And there's all kinds of speculation that this is happening to some degree. Right? As a matter of fact, I was talking to a person that was at this very meeting of the Chiapas Peace Network, and said, it all happened in 2008. Who knows? Who knows? But that was her, that these armed groups are going to come out in force in 2008. Now, just recently, and since you've been here, we've had a few incidents. Like, for example, a armed group called the EPR, the Revolutionary Popular Army, Ejército Popular Revolucionario, blew up some Pemex, our national oil company, installations. Okay. And there's all kinds of speculation whether or not the EPR is behind it or not.
Mm.
Because some folks say, hey, this sort of fits in to a familiar pattern. Is the EPR not Mr. Calderon's Osama bin Laden?
Right.
And are the explosions at the Pemex installations not our equivalent of the Twin Towers? In other words, giving Mr. Calderon all the justification that he needs to further militarize the country, but particularly the Pemex installations, which are slated to be privatized. Mr. Calderon has one thing on his mind, and that is to privatize the remaining two large state companies, which is the Federal
Electricity
Commission.
They already privatized the electoral.
Yes. And Pemex, the state oil company and the state electricity company, are slated to be privatized. He's going to put all of his interest and intent in carrying out the mandate from the United States as exercised through the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund to privatize these large, remaining large two state companies. Two words, huh? So, is the EPR really behind these bombings or not?
I doubt it.
Who knows? There are lots of people, lots of commentators, analysts, who say exactly as Carolina says, I doubt it. But we don't know, okay? What has happened to the Zapatistas and the other campaign in all of this? Well, it pains me tremendously to say so, but the bottom has dropped out of the other campaign. Very few people are showing up at the meetings with the other campaign. And one of the reasons is undoubtedly the whole question with the conflict with AMLO. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because Mr. AMLO was tremendously popular. Popular among whom? Popular among people in general who sympathized with both the Zapatistas and with AMLO. Right? And here you have Marco say, this guy is a total waste of time. Well, he said much worse things. Much, much worse things. And what happened? Well, really, AMLO became sort of like a sympathy figure, did he not? Because he was deprived from the presidency. And here you have this other guy saying, well, that's not important. Well, for an awful lot of people, that was important.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I have a theory. Marcos is right. We need to go past elections. And Marcos is right. Mr. AMLO wouldn't have changed much structurally. But see, this is something that the Mexican people have to experience themselves.
Yeah.
And if Mr. AMLO had come to power after July 2nd, last year, he would have done his bit, he would have handed out a little bit of money, and in 2012, next elections, people will say, oh my God, we've had the pre, this horribly corrupt, and then we went to the right with Fox, with the PAN, and then we went to the left, the whole lot, what did the Shakespeare say? A plague on both your houses, mm-hmm. but on all of your houses, right? We need to look for something different.
Right.
We need to look for something radically different, and then there would be the Zapatistas saying, uh-huh, see, we told you back in June of 2005 that was the case. But you see, I don't think you can, I think people have to experience that. Mm-hmm. Marcos, by implication, I don't know if he actually pointed the finger and said, well, you see, Brazil is a perfect example. There's that lefty Lula.
Oh, yeah.
He's got all the right leftist credentials. He's from a poor peasant family who rose up through the ranks of the Metal Workers Union and da-da-da, and then he founded the Workers' Party, and after four attempts, he became president. Well, what has he done? Has he inverted this triangle? Absolutely not. But you see, you can't tell the taxi driver
right.
out there, well, look at Lula.
Right. He doesn't know who Lula is.
He doesn't know who Lula is, basically. People have to live these experiences. See, I don't think you can deprive them and say, well, just let's try to make a quantum leap over there. Don't do that. The left is terribly, terribly, terribly divided.
Right, right.
It's been repressed violently, and then the whole collapse, the moral collapse, the energy collapse of losing, again in quotes, but in essence, losing the July 2nd elections, has the left is in tatters, if you will, and not knowing really, well, what are the options? Well, obviously one of them is to, let's go off into the mountains, right? But a lot of people say, well, that's been tried before. And who says it's going to work this time? So is that really an option? What are the options?
Mm-hmm.
What are the options? And we're in a moment that I referred to, or somebody else has referred to, we're in a moment where of great expectation, because Calderón has said, in words and in deeds, we're going to push through our project. if we're talking about mega projects, big projects for the multinationals that mean stripping indigenous people of their land and their rights and their natural resources, that, well, that's what we're going to do. And you better get out of the way. Because if you don't, you're going to be repressed. You saw what happened in Oaxaca. You saw what happened in Atenco. You better get out of the way. Okay. And what are the movements and the social organizations going to do? Are they going to get out of the way? Are they going to stand in the way? Are they going to do what that lone demonstrator in Tiananmen Square who stood in front of the tank? Is that what's going to happen? We're at precisely that moment where we're trying to figure out, well, what is it that we need to do? Mm. So, I would sort of leave it there. I would wrap it up right there. I haven't said anything terrible about water specifically, but that's one of the projects. I mean, privatizing, and you know this, I'm not going to tell you anything that you don't already know, but privatizing absolutely everything is one of the far right's mandates. Do you know that they're even selling, they're privatizing pieces of the ocean? Not just the rivers and the lakes and the, right? There's a way to measure from the satellite, right? And you can say, okay, these coordinates, that's yours, multinational corporation, and you have total rights to explore this particular part of the ocean, which is Mexico's, territory, offshore territory. So even the ocean is being privatized. Okay. So that's what's being pushed through. This agenda is coming down hard. And again, the groups on the left and the social movements, etc., are taking stock. What are we going to do? Because it's not a question of sitting down and negotiating, because Calderon has said, that's not an option. That's not an option. To such an extent that, do you know that Atenco, I've made reference to Atenco several times. Atenco started out as a protest against the expropriation by Fox of 15,000 or 25,000 hectares of land to build a new Mexico City airport just a few kilometers outside of Mexico City. Well, the people there said, wait a minute, we're farming here. These are lands that we, our grandfathers, spilled blood over during the Mexican Revolution so that we could have. And you're just going to expropriate them? No. So they protested for 9 months. Extremely successful. They won. After 9 months, Fox signed an order rescinding the expropriation. Okay? And they won. This was absolutely tremendous energy to social movements here in Mexico and throughout Latin America. It is possible for people to say no to these mega projects. Tremendously powerful. Well, now, Calderon and the army and the repressive force.
Well, that was Fox.
Right, that was Fox. Mm-hmm. Calderon has said, we're now, Atenco is once again on the table as far as an airport for
Mexico. Oh no, after all that?
Oh no.
You're a jerk.
So what's gonna happen? Well, as I said, we're in that moment where we're waiting for, what do you call it? The shoe to drop, some expression? We're waiting for the shoe to drop. What is going to happen? Are the social movements going to just lie down and play dead, or are lots of heads going to roll, and what's going to happen? Well, there we have it.
Great.
What a happy ending.
Well, I think I'm, you know, after last week I gave a talk to another group. This was a religious group. And after the talk, folks were looking at our little store, and one man came over and said to me, but are you optimistic? And I said, well, yes, in the long run. In the long run. Because what the Zapatistas say is right. That is what we need.
Right.
And I think that will happen.
We'll get it.
In the short run, I'm fairly pessimistic.
Yeah.
I'm fairly pessimistic. And especially so since I think that the far right, the neocons, take a lot of cues from what's happening in the United States.
Yes.
If they beat people over the head,
yeah.
Is the US government going to care?
No.
No. But they also know there's an election coming in 2008 in the United States. And it looks probable that the Democrats will win at this point, right?
That way.
Well, they did win.
Well, maybe you can get those chats to fall out correctly.
It's all electronic now. It's good. It's fixed. More ways than one.
It's all fixed. Well, the neocons are here. Are obviously are well aware that there may be a change in the administration, and the neocons may be voted out of office. And a few more noises might be made from the US State Department about gross, absurd violations of human rights in Mexico. Maybe.
Not too much.
Not too much, yeah. I'm reading Noam Chomsky's book here. This is, have you read this? This is very recommendable. This is the book, by the way, if I'm not mistaken, that Hugo Chavez held on. And he said, oh my God. He still smells of sulfur here from when Bush was here. And this is the book that he held up and said he recommended everybody read, right? And it immediately shot up to number one in the New York Times list. I think this is it. And yeah, this is it really is a downer as far as what the State Department says in terms of gross, horrible human rights abuses around the world. Right? Especially if those who are perpetrating them are kind to American interests. Okay.
Yeah.
So yeah, we can't be too optimistic that a Democratic, well yeah, there are all kinds of examples here of what Clinton did,
yeah.
Right? And did not do when there were gross violations of human rights in different parts of the world. So, but anyway, what I'm getting to with this particular point is perhaps the neocons here, this far-right sector, will try to push forward their agenda before 2000, well, the end of 2008. So yeah, we're waiting for the shoe to drop.
Oh dear.
What if an all-out assault on their power is if not impossible, would be to court defeat, then the idea of small organization, a lot of patience, looking at the long-term thing is really, you know, makes a lot of sense.
It does.
Assuming from what I've heard, it took them 10 years of organization in the communities before
exactly.
They actually appeared on the scene.
Exactly.
We're following that same, and I know that Guerrilla in Guatemala did, after some initial defeats, they began to learn that lesson too, and they didn't begin military actions until they had done their homework in the small communities. And I'm assuming that if we're really going to fight something that large, you really need to do over a long-term basis a lot of grassroots organizing and link people, so you don't have leaders that stand up and are going to get killed and that's the end of the
exactly.
movement, but instead you have a movement.
Right. Right. Exactly right. So I'm optimistic.
And blood.
So I don't know unless you have any other questions and comments. I would call it a night. If you would like to purchase some of our materials, we do have most of the materials are in Spanish, but we do have some things in English, and we do in right in front of the bathroom. We have a little store in your. Free to go in there right now. Because of the hour, I would ask that you not take too long You're welcome to come back. If you have some free time, you're welcome to come back and take all the time you want to look through our materials.
Of free time.
And did everybody get a copy of the Mesoamerican Migrant's Journey North?
Thank you so much.
We didn't touch on very many globalization issues, which I thought we were going to do.